Chapter 11. How scarce is Bitcoin really? Here's another question I get asked in investor meetings all the time. Can't someone just change the 21 million Bitcoin cap? It's just code, right? Code can be changed. So, is Bitcoin really as scarce as we think? We say that Bitcoin's 21 million supply is hard-coded, fixed and finite. But can someone change the algorithm or tweak the software? Can a hacker manipulate the supply? It has been suggested. In 2019, Matt Luongo, who works on a handful of crypto projects, called for a discussion on raising the 21 million cap. I was the guy that said we might have to one day raise the Bitcoin supply cap. Fight me. Why would anyone suggest raising the cap and kill Bitcoin scarcity? Well, it all comes back to mining. The number of Bitcoins minted is cut in half every 4 years. And that means Bitcoin miners get their revenue slashed by 50% after every halving. Eventually, in 100 years, there will be no new Bitcoin reward at all. Miners will get paid only in network transaction fees. Some say this won't be enough to incentivize miners to keep the network running. If miners stop powering the system, we lose security. Bitcoin grinds to a halt. That's the theory, anyway. Luongo suggested we might need to raise the 21 million cap so we can keep the Bitcoin mining reward in place for longer. So yes, Bitcoin supply could be increased, in theory. A group of Bitcoin nodes could agree to change the cap and run the new software with a new supply schedule. In reality, this is never going to happen. Just look at the backlash Luongo received from the community. There will only ever be 21 million Bitcoins. If you have a problem with that, get the fuck out of our community because you aren't welcome, said Cobra Bitcoin. Throughout Bitcoin's short history, any attempt to change Satoshi's original principles have been met with a vicious response. Previous Bitcoin forks have tried to alter Bitcoin's features or philosophy. Every single time, the market has rejected them. Bitcoin Cash, Bitcoin SV, Bitcoin Gold, the list goes on. Hundreds of coins have forked off Bitcoin in an attempt to improve it. The community has always rejected them. The 21 million supply cap is probably the most sacred feature of all. I will argue, the 21 million cap is Bitcoin. If some miners did alter the supply cap, it would no longer be Bitcoin. It would be a new coin and a new chain, and the community would viciously reject it. The original Bitcoin chain, with the 21 million hard cap, would continue. And value would stay there, as it always has done. The 21 million cap and the supply schedule is so intrinsic to Bitcoin, it will never be compromised. Nick Carter explains it best. The supply schedule is intrinsic to the protocol, asset, and system. It's one of the very few features that Satoshi clearly stipulated and encoded in the original design with no ambiguity. And in the eyes of the broader community, the 21 mil cap is perceived as inherent. Satoshi specifically mentions a predetermined number of coins in the white paper. And he referenced 21 million coins on the Bitcoin.org website when it launched. As Carter explains, those working on the Bitcoin protocol hold these early documents as sacred. A change to this core part of Bitcoin will simply never be accepted. Take it from Andrew Polstra, director of research at Blockstream, a company built specifically to support the development of Bitcoin protocol. In a recent interview, he said, "The point of Bitcoin is to be sound money. We care about scalability, we care about privacy, but soundness always comes first." Polstra is one of the key members of Bitcoin's development community, so you can believe him when he says the 21 million cap is sacred above all else at the core level. But what about the practical issue of diminishing mining rewards? Bitcoin researcher and educator Andreas Antonopoulos has a pragmatic answer. Nothing magical happens when block subsidy drops to zero. It's a very gradual and predictable change that happens over a period of 120 years. It's already happening, and every day, miners make their decision. Miners already adapt to huge supply shocks every 4 years when their revenue is cut in half. They know the supply schedule 120 years in advance, and they are prepared. They wouldn't be in business otherwise. We hear the same doomsday arguments every time the halving rolls around. Critics say Bitcoin will go into a mining death spiral every time the reward is cut in half. It never happens. If Bitcoin's core feature, hard-coded digital scarcity, is ever changed or compromised, it will not be Bitcoin anymore. The whole thing will have failed. So, can the 21 million supply be changed? Yes. Will it happen? Not a chance. Bitcoin is scarce. Bitcoin is finite. That's why it exists. What about other cryptocurrencies? Here's another criticism I get all the time. But anyone can create a cryptocurrency. There are 3,700 cryptos listed on CoinMarketCap. This isn't scarce. Another crypto could easily replace Bitcoin. I tell them three things. 1. Bitcoin not crypto. The revolution here is Bitcoin. The 21 million hard cap. The strongest computer network in the world with only one job, protecting sound money. Other cryptocurrencies aren't designed like this. They're tech projects. Some of them are super interesting, but they're just not the same bucket. There is nothing else out there designed to be hard digital money. Nothing. Cryptocurrencies aren't scarce, but BTC is and always will be. 2. Bitcoin has been tested and tested and tested. At this point, it's almost impossible that another cryptocurrency overtakes Bitcoin. Back in 2016 and 17, people tried to attack Bitcoin and change it and twist it. We had Bitcoin Cash, Bitcoin Gold, Bitcoin Private. They all failed. Bitcoin has survived a financial crisis. It's been banned and attacked and come out stronger. Bitcoin has been battle-tested unlike any other cryptocurrency. Unlike any asset in history, actually. I can't think of a single financial asset that has been attacked as viciously as Bitcoin and survived. 3. Bitcoin had an immaculate conception. It wasn't built for profit or power. It was built on the quietest corner of the internet as an experiment for cryptography geeks. And its adoption was completely natural and organic. No marketing campaign, no advertising budget, no CEO, no headquarters. Bitcoin was worth zero for 18 months after it was launched, and people still mined it because they believed in it. Just a pure thing that spread like wildfire. You can't engineer a network effect like that. Tech companies spend billions trying to recreate what Bitcoin did from nothing. No cryptocurrency will ever replicate its immaculate conception or the powerful army of Bitcoiners that defend it. 4. Money is a winner-takes-most technology. You don't go to Walmart and choose between different currencies. You use the dollar for now. The dollar dominates most of global trade and global reserves. Winner takes most of it. It's the same in the cryptocurrency market. Bitcoin is the largest and dominant cryptocurrency, by orders of magnitude. It's more than 6 times bigger than Ethereum, which isn't really money, and it definitely isn't hard money. The closest real competitor is Bitcoin Cash, which is 55 times smaller than Bitcoin. Would you call a social network a threat to Facebook if it was 55 times smaller? No, there is no competition for Bitcoin. Even our modern tech world is winner takes most. There is no rival to Google's search engine. There is no other YouTube, no credible rival to Facebook or Amazon. There's even a chance that BTC is winner takes all in the world of money. Like the internet swallowed everything. There is no other internet. It just is. Bitcoin could be the same. So, yes, Bitcoin is still scarce, and the 21 million cap is safe, and always will be. Chapter 12. Colonial money printer go brrr. So far, our entire history of money happened before America, as we know it, even existed. So how did the dollar end up becoming the world's global currency? First, the US had to go through the whole long process of money discovery itself. Here's how it played out. There's a scene in Disney's Pocahontas where John Smith arrives in America and tries to explain gold to Pocahontas, but she has absolutely no idea what he's talking about. Obviously, the Pocahontas movie is not historically accurate, so take this with a grain of salt. But this scene does describe what happened when the first European settlers tried to trade gold with the Native Americans. Pocahontas. Gold? What's gold? John Smith. You know, it's yellow, comes out of the ground, really valuable. Pocahontas. Oh, here, we have lots of it. She hands John an ear of corn. John Smith. No, gold is this. He hands her a gold coin. Pocahontas. There's nothing like that around here. Mica the raccoon bites the coin and throws it away. The Europeans had spent centuries building an entire financial system on gold coins. The British had even established banks. But when their ships arrived in New England in the 1500s, the Native Americans weren't interested in using it as money. Gold was worthless to them because they didn't share a belief in its value. The colonists were stuck. They couldn't trade with the locals. Instead, the Native Americans used animal skeletons and wampum, a type of clamshell. They stored them as beads on a pendant. If you want to pay someone, you took a few wampum beads from your pendant and swapped them with someone else. Just like all good monies we've discussed, wampum had all the right qualities. Durable, light, portable, fungible, standard units, difficult to forge, scarce. The settlers were forced to put their gold aside and trade with wampum. It became the legal tender of New England. Trade boomed. But then the money killer came back. Inflation. Shells were relatively scarce on land, but the European settlers realized they could dredge the ocean to find more. More and more boats arrived with better technology to harvest shells. Europeans used their manufacturing technology to mass produce wampum. The settlers became outrageously wealthy in clamshells, but they flooded the market, effectively destroying the value. Like every other time in history, America moved back to a scarcer money, gold coins. This is where the phrase shelling out came from. Everyone was forced to shell out and switch to gold coins. Wampum was still used in some parts of America up until the 20th century, but its value had inflated 100x. Another lesson in what happens when you flood the supply of money. It kills currency. Despite the early lesson in inflation, it wasn't long before America began experimenting with paper money. Colonial money printer go brrr. In the late 1600s, Hannah Duston and her six-day-old baby were captured by Native American soldiers. Her home was burned to the ground, and they dragged her and the child through frozen winter conditions back to Canada. On the way, an Abenaki warrior lost his temper and smashed Hannah's baby's head against a tree, killing it instantly. In a haze of revenge, Hannah later slaughtered nine of her captors in their sleep. She scalped them all and returned to Massachusetts to collect a scalp bounty. This is how vicious the King William's War was. Soldiers fighting in this battle were subjected to gruesome deaths, surprise massacres, scalping, and low pay in the frozen fields of New England. And then the money ran out. The Massachusetts treasury was almost empty of gold coins, and the state ran up enormous debt. Without pay, the soldiers were close to mutiny. The colonial authorities did the only thing they could think of: print paper money. The state of Massachusetts needed a quick way to pay soldiers, so they issued IOUs on paper. The first ever American money printer went brrr. The notes began to lose value almost as soon as they were printed. No one trusted the state to redeem each IOU in the future. Within a year, the notes had depreciated 40%. Within a couple of decades, the money was completely worthless. America's first money printing experiment failed. But the precedent was set, and the money printer was too tempting to ignore in times of war. Next time America turned it on, it was big: the Revolutionary War. This time, they printed a total of $200 million notes called Continentals to defeat the British and declare independence. This currency died even faster than the one before it. It wasn't backed by gold or silver, and they printed so much it was worthless within 5 years. People refused to accept it. By the 19th century, America and most countries around the world realized that good money had to be backed by hard assets. Around 50 countries adopted a gold standard, with the British pound acting as the dominant global currency. Paper money was commonplace, but every note was backed by an equal amount of gold held in a country's reserves. It's no coincidence that this period of time is when the Industrial Revolution took place. The biggest economic leap forward in history happened when most of the world's money was backed by a scarce asset: gold. As you can see, History is littered with short eras of money printing, and it always ends badly. When it failed in the past, we came back to gold. We always returned to hard money. Today, we're in another era of insane experimental money printing. Like all others in history, it will be brief and it will end badly. But when this one fails, we won't go back to gold. We'll turn to Bitcoin. In almost every way, Bitcoin is harder and better money than gold. We've just never had it before. This is another criticism I get all the time when pitching Bitcoin to investors. If Bitcoin is so much like gold, why don't I just buy gold instead? Why don't we just use gold as currency? Why? Because Bitcoin is 100 times better than gold. Chapter 13. Gold versus Bitcoin. Why investors are almost right, but not quite. In the middle of the 2020 crisis, everyone was looking to Warren Buffett. The man is considered one of the best investors in history, famous for buying when there's blood in the streets. He's the guy that walks into a burning house and starts negotiating with the owner to buy it. Back in the 2008 financial crash, he waited until Wall Street was on the brink of collapse, then strolled into Goldman Sachs to strike a deal. He's the coolest head in the investing world. So when the sky was falling in 2020, everyone waited to see what the Oracle of Omaha did next. There was plenty of blood in the streets, stocks were falling, the Fed was printing money like there's no tomorrow. What was Buffett going to buy? For a long time, he did nothing, keeping everyone in suspense. Then he made his move. Gold. Well, a gold mining company, Barrick Gold. This was a big deal. Buffett famously hates gold, a useless cube of metal, as he called it. It gets dug out of the ground in Africa or someplace, then we melt it down, dig another hole, bury it again, and pay people to stand around guarding it. It has no utility. But all of a sudden, Buffett wanted some kind of exposure to gold, and he cut some of his investments in the banks to free up the money. It hardly makes Buffett a raging gold bug or a Bitcoiner. He hates Bitcoin too. But you can read between the lines. He's hedging himself against inflation and all the money printing in 2020. Buffett wasn't the only famous investor running for gold during 2020. Billionaire Ray Dalio, who managed the world's largest hedge fund, fully understood what was going on in 2020. "Do not think that cash is a safe investment," he warned during the crisis. "Cash is a seductive investment because it doesn't have much volatility. But it taxes you and your buying power about 2% a year." So what did he do? He bought more gold. Dalio plunged $400 million into it during the second quarter of 2020, bringing his total exposure to more than $1 billion. In fairness, Dalio has always loved the shiny metal. "If you don't own gold, you know neither history nor economics," he once said. I put Warren Buffett and Ray Dalio in the bucket of almost right but not quite. They got almost everything correct in 2020. They understood history. They knew that central banks would never turn off the money taps, and that it would weaken the dollar. And they wanted some protection. But they came to the wrong conclusion. Instead of buying gold, they should be buying Bitcoin. I'm not saying that just because I've got skin in the game. Bitcoin is better than gold in almost every measurable way, both as money and an investment asset. We'll go through them in a minute. And Bitcoin is dramatically undervalued in comparison. Bitcoin's market capitalization is $280 billion. Gold is $9 trillion. Why Bitcoin is better than gold? Gold is not going to get a million times smarter in the next 10 years. Michael Saylor. In his brilliant essay, The Bullish Case for Bitcoin, Vijay Boyapati does a good job of ranking Bitcoin, gold, and fiat currencies against each other. I'll also throw in ramen too, just to keep it interesting. Can it be fucked with? Boyapati calls this censorship resistance in his essay, but this is what it really means, and I still think it's the most important quality in money. Can people take it away from you, stop you from using it, or manipulate the supply? Gold can definitely be fucked with. In 1933, President Roosevelt confiscated people's gold, made it illegal to own, and then literally charged the price from $20 per ounce to $35 to benefit themselves. As for the supply, gold miners can ramp up the production or slow it down whenever they like. They can search for new supply and find new reserves. Gold can be stopped and seized at a border, so it's not a whole lot better than fiat for moving internationally. As for fiat itself, we already know the dollar is fucked with on a daily basis. Unfortunately, ramen isn't great here either. The prison guards could easily confiscate the ramen, ban it from the jail shops, or increase the ramen supply. Bitcoin is the only money ever created that cannot be fucked with. Anyone can use it. No one can confiscate it. No one can inflate the supply. Portability. Gold is heavy, cumbersome, difficult to store, and ridiculous to send to other people. You probably need to hire an armored vehicle to move large amounts. Bitcoin is the most portable form of money ever invented. Hands down. I'm going to steal another one of Boyapati's quotes. Bitcoin is gold with magic teleportation properties. Gold is terrible for portability. We started using paper currency specifically because gold is heavy and useless for large exchanges. Even now, we hardly ever move gold physically. It all sits in safety deposit boxes. We just change the ownership on a computer. Ramen's not bad either, but it's not easy to shift a lot of noodles. Bitcoin moves across the world instantly. It's the most fluid form of money in history. Divisibility. Bitcoin is a digital thing, so it can be divided infinitely. I still hear people saying, "I can't afford a full Bitcoin," which is crazy. You can buy tiny amounts. The smallest Bitcoin denomination is a Satoshi, or a sat. That's 100 millionth of a Bitcoin. When one BTC is eventually worth $1 million, a sat will be equal to a penny. If you've heard the phrase stack sats, this is where it comes from. Gold is pretty terrible in this department. You can't cut up a gold bar or snap a coin in half. The smallest real denomination of gold is a troy ounce, which is worth about $653. Useless for any form of commerce. The dollar is pretty good here, divisible down to pocket change. Ramen? Not so much. I don't think prison inmates are snapping their ramen into smaller pieces to make micropayments. Scarce. You know this by now. Bitcoin has a 21 million hard cap. Can't be changed. The daily supply is programmed and grows scarcer with every halving. Gold is definitely scarce, but the total supply is still unknown. As for dollars, there is infinite cash at the Federal Reserve. Ramen is pretty scarce in a prison situation, which is why it works well in a jail economy, but not so much in the real world. Verification. Another huge win for Bitcoin. Bitcoin exists on a completely public database, verified by millions of computers every minute of the day. You can prove you own Bitcoin with a cryptographic signature. It's easy and costs almost nothing to do. And because the network is so secure, no one has ever successfully counterfeited a Bitcoin. Gold is also difficult to counterfeit, but not impossible. And it's very expensive to verify. Another fail for gold. Where gold wins. Don't get me wrong, I do like gold. I own some gold, and it's still got the edge on Bitcoin in a couple of ways. Durability. Gold is hard to beat in this department. Gold coins have survived for centuries and still have value despite the fall of governments and empires. As we've seen throughout history, people have always come back to gold when fiat money fails. It's physically durable and historically durable. The problem with fiat money is that it's only as durable as the government that issues it. Most fiat currencies have eventually fizzled out. I'd argue that Bitcoin is pretty durable. The network has never been hacked, and it's endured through every major attack so far. But in fairness to gold, it wins this round. Established history. As we've seen in our dive through history, gold has been valuable since the earliest days of trade. We can't compete with gold's long history of value. Bitcoin has only been around since 2009, so it's still early. This thing could still fail, although I don't think it will. Every day it doesn't die makes it increasingly likely to survive. This is called the Lindy effect. The longer something has been around in technology, the more likely it is to be here in the future. Ramen has been around since the 1660s, and it's definitely not going anywhere either. Fungible. Gold has got Bitcoin beat on this one too, but only just. Fungible means every unit is equal to another unit. If you melt down gold and make coins of equal weight, they're all worth the same. Bitcoin is similar. One BTC is always worth one BTC. But there's a catch. Because all Bitcoin transactions are public on the blockchain, we can trace the history of some coins. Coins used on the Silk Road or other sketchy activities could theoretically be blacklisted somewhere, giving them unequal value. Dollars are the same. Tainted or marked bills can be confiscated. Ramen? Pretty fungible. One pack of ramen is equally valuable to another. Gold's only redeeming feature over Bitcoin is time. It's been around longer. But gold has one huge problem. It can't evolve. Gold isn't going to get smarter or harder or better, but Bitcoin is. Because Bitcoin is digital, it is constantly evolving and growing, getting ever harder and more durable. MicroStrategy's Michael Saylor puts it best in one of my favorite ever paragraphs about Bitcoin. Bitcoin is the hardest currency because it's getting continually, exponentially harder. This entire thing is its own ecosystem. It's a living thing, which means that the miners are going to keep upgrading their equipment. The developers are going to keep updating their development. The nodes are going to change. Every part of the ecosystem is going to change. And they're changing in this terrifying, Darwinian, capitalistic, libertarian, aggressive, winner-takes-all, hold-no-bars way. Every day that Bitcoin survives, it grows stronger. The network becomes more secure. The supply gets more scarce. Bitcoiners get more convicted. The hash rate protecting this thing is off the charts. The swarm of cyber hornets gets bigger every day. Even when the price goes down, the amount of computing power securing the Bitcoin network is at record highs. Sure, gold is hard money, but Bitcoin is hard money that grows exponentially harder every day. Gold, a bet against human ingenuity. There's another problem with gold. If you buy gold, you're betting against humanity. You're betting that we can't figure a way out of the problems we're facing. We've got to go back to rocks instead. I think differently. I trust humanity to come up with new solutions. I trust technology and human innovation. I trust there's a better alternative out there, like Bitcoin. And it's more literal than that, too. We already know the gold supply isn't finite. There are untapped gold reserves in the ocean and in space. I trust that humans will figure out a way to get it. I trust that Elon Musk will probably take us to Mars and start mining gold up there. I trust that we'll develop better technology to dredge the oceans of gold. It's just human ingenuity. And if that happens, the price of gold gets pushed down. The same thing happened with oil. Everyone thought we had drilled all the available oil wells, and then engineers figured out fracking. It trebled oil production in 10 years. If there's a way to do it, humans will eventually figure it out. Instead, I trust in hard code. I trust that Bitcoin's 21 million hard cap is rock solid, unfuckable. That's why Bitcoin is better than gold. This last point isn't exactly scientific, but I think it's important. Gold is a relic of the past, and it's a pessimistic solution for a new digital era. Gold bugs are a grumpy bunch. Go listen to a Peter Schiff podcast. You'll see what I mean. Bitcoiners and gold bugs mostly agree on the problem: money printing, devaluation, and central bank control. But we disagree on the solution. Gold bugs want to go back to a version of the past. It was better in my day. They think the whole system is doomed and want to return to a gold standard where everything is backed by a shiny rock. Bitcoin is optimistic. It's a new version of the future that fits in our new digital world. It's an open financial system that empowers people no matter where they live. Millions of unbanked who can't access a traditional bank account can use Bitcoin. Migrants can send money back home across borders. Families in inflation-ridden countries can store their wealth in a safer financial system. And eventually, countries can trade with each using an independent and neutral currency. Bitcoin is fair, open, peaceful, and digitally native. Bitcoin is a pretty grumpy sometimes too, but we definitely have a more optimistic view of the future. Gold bugs want to preserve the past. Bitcoiners want to actively build a better future. Gold isn't a 10x opportunity. Lastly, as an investment asset, there's just no way that gold can compete. Bitcoin has the potential to massively appreciate in price. Gold doesn't. Let's go all the way back to the valuations. Bitcoin is measurably better than gold in almost every single way, as money and as an investment class. Bitcoin is built for the future digital era, while gold is stuck in the past. Yet gold's market capitalization is $9 trillion. Bitcoin's is $280 billion. Bitcoin's value could double, triple, times 10, and it still wouldn't overtake gold's market cap. To equal gold's value, a single Bitcoin would be worth about $500,000, a 34x opportunity. Bitcoin is objectively better than gold in almost every way, so its price will eventually grow to reflect that. Gold has probably already reached close to its total addressable market. Bitcoin is just getting started. Anyway, now we've established that Bitcoin is better than gold, let's get back to the history of money. We know that infinite money printing destroys currencies through history, so why do they do it? There's one big reason that comes up time and time again. War. Chapter 14. War. What is it good for? Printing money. One day in Germany, 1923, a man sat down for a coffee in a Hamburg cafe. He ordered his first coffee, costing him 5,000 German marks. Half an hour later, he ordered a second coffee. The price had gone up to 9,000 marks. It almost doubled whilst he sat there. "What's going on?" he asked. "Sorry," the waiter replied. "The price went up while you were drinking the first one." Germany was suffering from insane hyperinflation of its currency after the First World War. Deutschmarks were losing their value every minute of the day. Waiters stood on tables every half hour to shout the updated menu prices. Employees took their worthless salary banknotes home in wheelbarrows. Kids were playing on the streets with paper chains made of Deutschmarks. Money was used as wallpaper. Life savings were wiped out in less than a year. All of a sudden, $1 was equal to 4,200,000,000,000 marks. When hyperinflation hits, it hits fast. At the start of 1923, there were 8.6 billion Deutschmarks in circulation. By the end of the year, it was 40 quintillion. What the hell happened? World War One. There's one common theme in history when the money gets screwed up. War. Just like the brutal King William's War in early America, World War One was expensive, and the only way to pay for it was printing money. Before World War One, Germany's currency was fully backed by gold, just like most currencies around the world at the time. But now they had to pay for military action. Germany decided to break the link between gold so they could print more money and borrow like crazy. They defended the decision by calling it an economic necessity. As things stand, the only way to finance the cost of fighting the war is to shift the burden into the future through loans, said economist Karl Helfrich, 1915. It would be worth it, right? When Germany secured victory over Europe, there would be an economic boom. They'd rule over resource-rich nations and charge reparations to the countries they defeated. This is the lie governments tell themselves when they print money to fight wars. Again, there were plenty of rebellious voices at the time. Edward Bernstein warned in 1918, "There is a point at which printing money affects purchasing power by causing inflation." But no one listened. All the countries fighting in World War One dropped the gold standard. Britain, with the world's dominant currency, started borrowing money for the first time. Germany lost the war, and the economy was crippled. Worse, they had to pay reparations, 132 billion gold marks, about 33 billion or 100,000 tons of gold at the time. On top of the black hole of debt they built up during the war, Germany now had to borrow even more to pay the reparations. It was a chokehold on the German economy, and people lost all faith in the currency. Like the death of all currencies, it happened slowly at first. 50% devaluation in a year, gradually becoming 50% a month, then 50% a day, then it was worthless. Guess what happened next? Germans began demanding food and real resources as payment instead.
Sausages, eggs, coal. When currencies fail, humans seek out real assets. It's the ramen economy. The poor and middle class are hit the worst. As we know, inflation absolutely ravages the poor and middle class. The rich get richer, the poor get poorer. The German middle class, who saved Marx their whole life for retirement, were destroyed in less than a year. The poor who were already struggling to get by? They couldn't even afford to buy eggs because the little money in their pocket was worthless. Franz Geyer, a mayor in the region, said, "Never in my life have I seen such swarms of starving people wandering about." But the rich did just fine. They weren't holding much cash. They owned assets. Houses, factories, farmland. And they financed it all with debt. When the currency hyperinflated, that debt was now almost worthless, so they could pay it off in a flash. Lion Fustfanger wrote about the inequality he saw across Germany at the time. Farmer Grindelberger drove from the grimy village street of Ingolschalking to Munich in an elegant limousine, complete with a liveried chauffeur, while he himself was dressed in a brown velvet jacket and a green chamois tufted hat. The savage inequality led to a rise in populism and anger. And we know what happened next. One historian wrote, "This hyperinflation made Hitler possible." I'm not exaggerating when I say money printing leads to wars. For centuries, Europe had been home to the world's dominant currencies, the Florentine Fiorino, Portuguese and Spanish currencies, the Dutch guilder, the French franc, the British pound. But after World War I and World War II, that all changed. They drove their currencies into the ground by printing money. Here comes the dollar. Chapter 15. How the dollar became the global reserve currency. "Do you know there's gold under here?" My buddy pointed down to the sidewalk right in the middle of Fulton Street, New York, back before 9/11. "Under the ground?" I almost laughed at him. "Yeah, somewhere under the Twin Towers. There's a secret vault with, like, half the world's gold in it. They store gold for different countries. That's the rumour, anyway." That rumour turned into a full-blown conspiracy theory when the Twin Towers collapsed. Did the attackers mastermind the whole thing to destroy or loot half the world's gold reserves? There were stories of armoured trucks weaving through underground tunnels to move millions of dollars worth of gold bullion while the towers burned. It turns out the story is half true. There really was a gold storage vault under 4 World Trade Center, but it never held national gold reserves. It belonged to the Bank of Nova Scotia, and it held gold for traders and investors. Reports appear to confirm that an armored truck did go in to retrieve some of the gold from the rubble. From here on out, things get into sketchy conspiracy theories, so we'll leave that there. As for the rumor about the world's gold reserves, that's also half true. There really is a gigantic storage system under Manhattan that stores gold for nation states, but it wasn't under the Twin Towers. It's up the street at the Federal Reserve Building. The vaults are 80 feet below ground level, sitting right on the bedrock of Manhattan Island. The facility holds somewhere between a fifth and a quarter of the entire gold ever mined on Earth. Each vault belongs to a different country, and there really are gold bars stacked up inside. Workers move the bars from vault to vault at the end of each year to balance the books. But the vaults aren't marked, so they don't know which country's gold is being moved. It's a secretive operation. The rest of America's gold is held at Fort Knox, a military base outside Louisville, Kentucky. It's one of the most guarded and secure places on the planet, home to 50% of our nation's gold reserves, and it's carefully guarded. The base is surrounded by a minefield and razor wire, flanked by 4 machine gun towers. Inside the underground facility, the vault door is almost 2 feet deep and weighs 22 tons. The door itself has a 100-hour time lock, and no single person at the facility knows how to open the vaults. Hidden in those vaults is 147 million troy ounces of gold, or about 4,580 metric tons. But back in 1941, Fort Knox held 4 times that much, 649.6 million ounces. This is how America became the world's monetary superpower. It accumulated most of the world's gold. While Europe was busy destroying itself and debasing its money, through two horrific wars, America acted as the bank. The US government sold weapons and supplies to Britain and France and loaned them money to fight World War II. Most of it was paid for in gold. By the end of the war, America had amassed two-thirds of the world's gold reserves. If you've got all the gold, you've got all the power. This was a sneaky and brilliant move by the US. The world was in chaos, so America accumulated as much wealth as it could in hard money terms, gold. When Europe's paper money imploded, everyone turned to America for help. By the way, this is why I believe governments around the world will soon begin stockpiling Bitcoin, an even harder asset than gold. If the money printer destroys the dollar, we'll be looking around again to see who's holding all the real value and power in Bitcoin and gold. That country will be the next global superpower. Bretton Woods. In July 1944, a delegation of 44 countries arrived at Bretton Woods, New Hampshire, with their tail between their legs. America sat on its gigantic pile of gold and declared the next era of money, a global dollar system. Most global currencies would now be linked to the dollar, and the dollar would be backed by gold, a kind of global gold standard. America became the bank of the world. Nations would deposit their gold at the US Federal Reserve and load themselves up with dollars. They'd buy US debt in the form of treasury bills. And it worked relatively well. There was stability around the world with gold and the dollar acting as a secure peg, and it was one of the most prosperous times in history. It's known as the Golden Age of Capitalism, the post-war boom. And it's because of the dollar. The world finally convened around a new global reserve currency, backed by gold. Trade flourished. As we know through history, whenever rival tribes or countries agreed on a new universal form of scarce money, whether it was barley or gold coins or wampum, the economy boomed. As Bitcoiners say, fix the money, fix the world. Well, until there was another war. How the Vietnam War broke the dollar. In February 1965, the US quietly launched a bombing attack in North Vietnam. For the next 3 years, American forces pummeled the Ho Chi Minh Trail with bombs through Operation Rolling Thunder. US troops descended on the beaches of South Vietnam. The Vietnam War was longer and bloodier than anyone expected, which means it was also more expensive. America began borrowing money at a ridiculous pace, and when that wasn't enough, they started printing dollars. Other nations got nervous about the American economy. They panicked and demanded their gold back from the US. Francis Charles de Gaulle was one of the most aggressive. He converted 150 million of dollar reserves back to gold and threatened another 150 million. He was furious at America and reminded the world of how important independent hard money was. We consider it necessary that international trade should rest, as before the two world wars, on an indisputable monetary basis having the mark of no particular country. What basis? Indeed, there can be no other criterion, no other standard than gold. De Gaulle basically triggered a bank run on Fort Knox. France and other nations pulled their gold out of the US. The dollar supply was increasing, but America's gold reserves were going down. The US was making the same mistake as Germany and Britain before. They printed money and ran up debts to pay for a war that nobody wanted. It put the entire dollar system at risk. The end of the gold standard. In August 1971, President Richard Nixon addressed the nation and changed the nature of money forever. "We must protect the dollar as a pillar of monetary stability around the world. Accordingly, I have directed Secretary Connolly to suspend temporarily the convertibility of the dollar into gold or other reserve assets." Nixon officially pulled the dollar off the gold standard. America's money, and the world's reserve currency, was no longer backed by gold. We already know what happens when a nation stops backing its currency with hard assets. Massive devaluation. But Nixon promised this wouldn't happen. "Let me lay to rest the bugaboo of what is called devaluation. If you are among the overwhelming majority of Americans who buy American-made products in America, your dollar will be worth just as much tomorrow as it is today." He was dead wrong. That bugaboo of devaluation hit hard. Within a decade, the dollar lost a third of its value. The money supply in 1971 was $401 billion. It's now $18 trillion. The Bureau of Labor Statistics has some hard numbers on this. Consumer prices today are 540% higher than they were in 1971. And the purchasing power of a dollar has dropped 84% in that time. Why don't we learn? This happened back in China in 1100 AD. It happened in the US back in the 1700s. It happened in Europe in the 1900s. It happens every time. If you print money without a hard asset backing it, you destroy the value of your currency over time. It's that simple. In every single case through history, the dominant currency was eventually replaced when they turned on the money printer. And right now, we're printing more money than any time in history. Do you really think this time is different? This does not end well.